If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Welcome to our new four-part mini-series, in which we'll be looking back at festive food from down the ages, from the fairly revolting to the downright delicious and sadly forgotten dishes that have graced our Christmas tables over the centuries. I'm joined in this culinary adventure by Annie Gray, food historian and the author of At Christmas We Feast, Festive Food Through the Ages. And for our final episode today, we're taking a look back on festive food in the 20th century. From the suspect dishes made under World War II rationing, to Fanny Craddock and joyful post-war creations coated in piped green mayonnaise. In this episode, we're going to look at Christmas in the Second World War and also in the post-war era. We might need to break those into two separate things. To start us off, what would sum up Christmas during the Second World War?
A sense of yearning, I think. A sense of Christmas being the thing you really, really need to get you through the year. And a sense that as long as you manage something, then actually it's all okay.
Did people want to celebrate Christmas during the Second World War? Was there a sense, as you say, of it something to look forward to rather than it being deemed in not good taste, for example?
I think the Second World War actually made Christmas far more than the Victorian era because Christmas became a real focal point every single year during the war. And indeed afterwards, because of course rationing went on until 1954, the Ministry of Food and various magazines exhorted people to make the most of the ration. There was extra sugar, there was extra dried fruit, there were extra suet. There was this sense that Christmas was a thing. And it wasn't considered in bad taste because actually there was a sense that you've got to do something to get through this horrendous era. I think one of the things that comes through very strongly in diaries of the era and letters is this sheer stress people were living under. A lot of people, certainly on the home front, were not directly affected. Yes, there were people being blitzed out. If you were in an urban centre, it was difficult. If your children had been evacuated or if you knew somebody who was fighting, especially once the front in France opened out, it was hard. But for a lot of people, it really was just a question of getting on with it most of the time. And the occasional, or indeed frequent, bit of grief or terribleness, it happened, but you had to keep on living. And Christmas was something that really helped. So the idea that you could, for just a short period each year, decorate your house, concentrate on your children because you needed to give them something because this war wasn't going to last forever, and have a celebration with whatever you could have to hand, it was a really, really strong thing. And I think, again, you can overplay senses of community or of belonging or of love or of joy. But Christmas became so emblematic in the Second World War that afterwards, once you reach what I sort of refer to as the Technicolor period, Christmas has become absolutely embedded as something that you cannot gainsay. You know, I mean, the Scottish didn't do Christmas before the 1950s. Hogmanay was the big thing. But after the war, Christmas just bulldozed everything in its wake.
Mm. You spoke earlier about there being a sense of yearning surrounding Christmas at this time. And just so we can understand the impact of the restrictions and rationing in the Second World War, give us a sense of what Christmas had been like in the 1930s. What had people given up?
Well, 1930s Christmas was... It was an era of much better living standards than previously. So previously, we've always talked in these episodes about the Christmas of the rich and then sort of talked a little bit about the Christmas of poorer people. But living standards started to rise quite a lot by the end of the 19th century. Things like frozen meat coming in from Argentina and New Zealand really, really improved the diet of the working poor. Battery farming, for all its ills and intensive farming systems, did mean that the diets of people improved. In the First World War, everyone had a wage, so living standards went up. I know we've gone through the Great Depression and a lot of people suffered, but a lot of people didn't. If you kept your job, you were fine. So in the 1930s, Christmases were becoming more rigid. The Victorians had certainly managed to codify Christmas quite well. And menus at the time universally involve roast turkey or still sometimes roast goose and still sometimes actually duck and things like that, so poultry, potatoes, a Christmas pudding, a Christmas cake, sweets, loads and loads of chocolate at Christmas. Confectionery went mad. So the idea of, you know, a tin of Quality Street. What else says Christmas? Other brands also did apply, but I'm afraid to say Quality Street was the big one. Ice cream would be in, and it would be a lot of food. And it was much more a nuclear family gathering by now. You might well go to grandma's, or you might have grandma over, or whatever it was. But you're talking sort of maybe 8 to 10 people in most cases, rather than 15 to 20 people. And servant keeping was still very much a thing for the wealthy, a huge thing. I mean, servants were most of the female population, working female population, still were in domestic service. But there was a sense that you would go home to your family. A lot of servants lived out so that they could spend Christmas at home. You know, it was a period where people got together from wherever they were. They got on the train. They shared vast quantities of chocolates and biscuits, and they had a really lovely meal, replete with loads of dairy, loads of meat, loads of sugar, and all of that just got swept away. I mean, Christmas of 1939 wasn't too bad, but rationing hit January 1940 and pretty much everything I've listed went on the ration.
Yeah, so dairy, meat, sugar, were those the main victims of rationing when it came to Christmas dinner?
Yes. So meat was rationed by price. So you could choose whether you had quite a lot of stewing steak or not very much really nice steak. So sugar was rationed. It was very heavily restricted because obviously it was imported. I mean, sugar beet was a thing. We could produce sugar in Britain by that point, but still a lot of it was imported. You then had also eggs. So anything, you know, eggs, great. What do you need for a pudding? You need eggs. What do you need for a cake? You need eggs. What do you need to bind your stuffing? You need eggs. So, and eggs were really, really scarce. Then also dried fruit wasn't on the ration to start off with, but was very, very in very short supply. And then it did go on the ration, and sometimes things were on points as well. Suet, that counted as meat. So that was really hard to get hold of. Oranges for your orange zest and your flavours. No chance. Any exotic fruit, no chance. If it was imported, basically, you'd be lucky. Pretty much everything that you can think of that you might want to put in your Christmas hamper. I mean, potatoes. Get loads of potatoes. Potatoes are fine, especially if you've got a garden. I have to say, if this one ingredient that sums up the wartime Christmas, it is potato. Narrowly in front of carrots.
So in this straitened circumstance, this has been the first time that I've asked this in one of these episodes, but what was the government messaging around Christmas food? Was it make the best of what you can, or did they have specific recipes that they suggested for people to make the most of the ration?
The government was very heavily involved with food in the Second World War. The Minister of Food, Lord Walton, was incredible. I think, you know, he is one of the big heroes, really, of the Second World War. And one of the big heroes, I would say, of food in general, certainly in the 20th century. He was well aware that morale would suffer if people couldn't get hold of their Christmas dinner. And he was also aware of that morale would suffer if things looked unequal. So where previously Christmases were very, very unequal, now they still were, realistically speaking, because if you were wealthy, you could get hold of unrationed ingredients that were expensive. You might well have your own estate to have game, that kind of thing. But the ration was the same for everybody. So absolutely everybody was guaranteed a certain level of tea, of sugar, of eggs. And if you supplemented it by keeping your own hens or whatever, that was fine. But it looked very, very fair. But in order for that to work, especially when standards of cookery were relatively low and knowledge of cookery was relatively low and a lot of people were having to cook for themselves for the first time, the Ministry of Food put out lots and lots of leaflets. And also there were programmes on the radio, such as The Kitchen Front with Ambrose Heath, where tips and tricks were given. And the pamphlets are brilliant. I mean, a lot of the food from the war is horrific. People sometimes think or say to me, you know, a rationing diet, I'll lose so much weight, won't it be really good? You're like, yeah, but you'll be so bored. And actually the food will be terrible. And I think as well, a lot of the suggestions made by cookery writers, including those that were government sponsored, were totally unrealistic. You have things like mock goose and mock turkey, which, you know, as you can imagine, is potato. And actually, the idea of making a faux meatloaf that vaguely looks like it might once have been a turkey with no bones, no. Everybody knows that you can't get hold of it, so why pretend? Either stick a rabbit on the table or just, you know, do what you can do. So I have a strong suspicion that some of the more outre recipes were not cooked. They appeared. And also, a lot of those appear very early on in the war, where people are still very enthusiastic about, you know, making the most, whereas later on, it's a bit more about being realistic, like bison rabbits, or, you know, use a pig snout or something like that. People do still want the kind of stereotypical meat with trimmings at this point, but it's not always possible.
So you've told us about some of the least successful substitutions there, mock goose, for example. But what were some of the most successful substitutions?
Well, I've got a wartime Christmas cake in the book, which is genuinely lovely. I mean, you do have to pimp it a bit. You do have to add a little bit of, you know, hoarded spice and cocoa powder that you might not actually have had. But it is an eggless cake, which genuinely is lovely, really moist, really nice. It's not what I would call a Christmas cake because I am very much an aficionado of the rich fruit that you sort of throw through windows and it kills people and lasts forever. But it is nice. And I do have a soft spot for a bit of carrot in a Christmas pudding, although, to be honest, I'm struggling right now because a lot of the wartime food was so awful. I did make a wartime Christmas pudding. I did a whole pudding off at one point to try and find a pudding recipe to put in the book, puddings from loads of different eras. And the wartime one I had high hopes for because I cooked carrot-based Christmas puddings before and they've been very nice. But, it was fawn. Almost beige, to be honest, with orange bits in. So it did look a little bit like a sort of solid sick. And it didn't keep. I mean, you know, Christmas puddings in the past were very rarely made far in advance. You'd make it and you'd serve it straight off. The whole idea of sort of stir up Sunday or whatever and making it and keeping it or maturing it, very much a modern concept. But I mean, this thing didn't keep more than 2 weeks before a faint sheen of blue started to appear on it. To be honest, the vast majority of things didn't work. I mean, I would say if you're going to steer clear of any food era, then that would be the one to steer clear of, to be honest. I mean, the Ministry of Food did suggest that instead of a fruit bowl, you could have a beetroot bowl because it would look gay and lovely because it would be also brightly coloured.
In the previous eras we've discussed, the emphasis has very much been on meat and rich sauces, and definitely not on vegetables. But I presume that there was a lot more vegetables at play in the Second World War.
There were, but they still cooked them in a really bad fashion. I mean, it's got to be said that if you're vegetarian and looking for past recipes, it is a struggle to find decent ones unless you start to convert things. I'd love to fly the flag for suddenly vegetable cookery becoming brilliant in the Second World War, but it didn't. We just kept boiling things to the point of death. And we couldn't even serve them with melted butter sauce anymore because butter was rationed and flour was hard to get hold of. And so No, and also fuel was difficult. So it wasn't even like you could roast your vegetables in a beautiful oven, because to be honest, you're trying to conserve fuel as well. So hay box cookery actually was one of the few things that was, it made a comeback. Hay box cookery wasn't invented in World War II, but it's the concept from the, really from the Victorian period, where you have a wooden box, which you fill with straw or indeed other insulation material in a modern context. And you sort of put a blanket on top of it, make a hollow. And then you have a stew usually, which you bring to the boil on a hob, and then you put that stew into your hay box, put the lid on and pad it down with much more straw and leave it for 6 or 7 hours.
Like a slow cooker.
Very much like a slow cooker, but without any actual power. And what happens is, as long as you've got it hot and as long as you're using a thick enamelware saucepan, it will cook over that 6 to 7 hour period. And then you just need to reheat it to serve it. So it's a really good low fuel way of cooking. And I've done sort of pig cheeks with quince and things like that in that way. And it does work really, really well, though you do need obviously space to put it in. And in a modern context, obviously a slow cooker or a low oven is a more sure way of doing things. And then you don't have the space problems. But vegetables still were a problem. People did eat a lot of vegetables. By the end of the war, the nation was healthier than it had ever been before, because the rich had their sugar and meat and dairy intake restricted, and the poor were guaranteed a certain level of meat and other bits and pieces. So, you know, and also everybody ate loads and loads and loads of fruit and vegetables, which is brilliant. But it rebounded massively in the 1950s when our sugar consumption went through the roof and we ate more per capita than we've ever eaten before or since. And people didn't like vegetables very much, and they just wanted a steak because that was what they couldn't get hold of during the war. So, I really loved to be able to tell you that vegetable cookery was amazing. Really, really wasn't.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So I find it quite a difficult era from a food point of view, because the kind of thrill-seeking part of me is like, yeah, this is so cool. But the rest of me thinks this is so much work and it's really not fair. And how much of this is actually about finding reasons for women to stay at home and turn out more and more exotic meals in lieu of doing anything more meaningful?
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
I want to move on to the 1950s in a moment, but one final point before we do. While we're talking about the era of make, do and mend, something I did want to ask you about, a Christmas staple, is leftovers. Not necessarily in the Second World War, but what have been some of the most useful recipes for rustling up some tasty leftovers in the past?
Well, I always have a real problem with the idea of leftovers because it's somehow quite pejorative. And people think of leftovers as something which are kind of sloppy seconds. And even the concept is relatively modern. So you don't really get the word leftovers even until quite late on into the 20th century. And it's very much a kind of post-fridge development. Once you've got a fridge and you can put things in plastic containers and leave them to die, then you get leftovers. Previously, you had cold meat cookery, and it was, again, the emphasis was on the meat because that was the expensive bit. Or you had sort of recipes to use previously cooked ingredients, and that was the light in which they were seen. So you didn't have leftover potato. You had a really conveniently ready cooked set of starchy things to put into a pudding or a curry or whatever. I think one of my favourite recipes for using leftovers is a vegetable curry, actually, from 1901. And it's in a recipe book by Catherine Mellish. And she uses sort of small amounts of pre-cooked vegetables. So anything, beans, cauliflower. And I mean, normally, let's face it, if I cook vegetables, then I'll just be like, oh, let's just eat them all. You don't leave kind of half a cup of boiled cauliflower or whatever. But in a modern context, I frequently have small amounts of things in the fridge, often because I'm a gardener and I don't produce very much. So I'm afraid to say that I get a handful of peas or three radishes that survived the slugs, or, you know, two broad beans or whatever it is, one tiny cabbage that didn't ever form a head. So this is a really, really useful recipe for using up bits of vegetables. And actually, it does come into its own at Christmas, where people are so full that they might leave just a minuscule amount of whatever it is, sprouts. And it's really easy as well, because you just sort of chuck everything into a pan with loads of desiccated coconut. You use cucumber and apple as a base, which is the only kind of must do. And the cucumber and apple are fried off, and then you use just plain curry powder, and you can chuck in cream, but you can also make it vegan by not adding any cream, and also by using oil instead of butter as the frying medium. And it's a really, really good, very simple recipe. And the apple and the cucumber give it a fruitiness. And then, because you can use any vegetables you want to, it's very much not something that you would eat, I suspect, anywhere in India or Pakistan or Bangladesh. It's very much an Anglo-Indian curry, but it is excellent and it is very versatile.
So let's turn now to the post-war era. I'm thinking here about the era after rationing, which, of course, as you say, continued into the 1950s. What sums up Christmas in the post-rationing age?
I think just food colouring, actually. I was going to say joy, but it's more just food colouring. I think there's a sense of just relief. You know, we've all heard the phrase, Britain's never had it so good. And for a lot of people, that was true. It's an era where everything comes flooding back again. And after 14 years of not being able to get hold of ingredients, people are like, oh my God, yes, let's just do what we can. So, you know, blue food colouring, which wasn't a thing in most eras. So much blue, pink, bright pink, Fanny Craddock. I mean, you know, is there more of an iconic person for that era than Fanny Craddock, who is a total hero, cooking in a wipe clean evening gown in the Albert Hall, and, you know, sort of suggesting that people use shears to cut up their turkey, and that if they're going to stab something, they think of their neighbour's head. I mean, she's absolutely brilliant. And most of the food that she cooks looks appalling, but there's a joy to her and a kind of flamboyance. And I think flamboyance really does sum up the cooking of the 1950s, actually, late 1950s and 60s. There are, you know, I've got pamphlets called things like Let's Have a Party, and the food is ridiculous, and your teeth melt when you eat it, and everything comes out of a tin. But there's just this sheer level of, do you know what? We haven't had this for so long. Break out the whipped cream. Bake out the buttercream, break out the cake, break out the Swiss roll, break out the boiled ham, break out the marmalade, break out the sprouts. Let's just go for it. So it is kind of cool.
So what are those, some of the post-war abominations, you know, the real out there weird stuff?
Well, I quite like the out there weird stuff. I mean, this is a big era for canapé parties and the old hostess trolley. And I've got to say, I've got a sneaking love for a serving hatch. But this is the era of, you know, the classic, let's take a pineapple, cut the lid off it, hollow it out, fill it with mayonnaise and stick cocktail sausages in it. Which I do admit actually is pretty grim. And piped green mayonnaise on everything at the Christmas tables. If you're going to serve hard-boiled eggs, you're going to obviously take the lid off and then take them out, mix the yolk with a bit of mustard and turmeric and put it back in again, and then pipe green mayonnaise around the top and roll an anchovy on it. You've got to colour everything, absolutely everything. I mean, there's a cake that I made once from the 1950s where you take a sponge cake, you hollow out most of it, you dump an entire can of fruited syrup into it, and then you smear the outside with jam, roll it in desiccated coconut, and then pipe whipped cream on top. And it's great for a sort of, you know, low-key Christmas dessert, but it's not very nice. So there are some pretty awful things that come out of it.
From what you're saying about food colouring, whipped cream, crazy displays, is the emphasis then on joyous display and the visuals more than a delicious taste?
Yes, I have to say, I do believe that this is one of those eras, a little bit like the Edwardian period, where style is somewhat over substance. I mean, you see it with fashion too. You know, women's fashion goes really over the top and brilliant for a while, but also very, very difficult to wear because those big skirts are extraordinarily itchy and actually girdles are quite uncomfortable as well. There's a sort of sense of reaching back, and there's a lot of stuff in aspic as well, which is a very Edwardian thing, but there is a real, yes, a real visual sense. And I think because this is also an era where mass manufacturing has been a huge part of life in Britain since really the late 19th century. But this is an era where a lot of small businesses are being swallowed up by big businesses and where the supermarkets are starting. You know, you'd never dream of making your own custard at this point. Of course you're going to use birds. And when it comes to gravy, it's going to be Bisto or Bovril put into the gravy. You know, all the brand names that we associate today with certain foods and certain things, they're inescapable at this point. It's not even just that they're there. They are all kind of just part and parcel of it. And I think it's also, to me, it's a very difficult era as a woman because a lot of this stuff is very time consuming. And while some women do not work, many women do work. Many women after the war were desperate to get back to the kitchen. Others were not. And these are dishes which we look at them and we laugh. And we think, gosh, you know, who would fill a cream horn with green coloured whipped cream and then flavour it with maraschino and stick silver balls in it? And you think, well, it's kind of cool. But we forget that this is an era where people do not have servants in the way they used to. So this is one woman usually slaving over a hot stove, literally, to get a massive meal on the table with all these canapés also prepared. And Fanny Craddock says things like, this is a shortcut. You can do this and it will save you loads of time. But she's still suggesting you do it in the first place. So I find it quite a difficult era from a food point of view because the kind of thrill-seeking part of me is like, yeah, this is so cool. But the rest of me thinks this is so much work and it's really not fair. And how much of this is actually about finding reasons for women to stay at home and turn out more and more exotic meals in lieu of doing anything more meaningful?
Yeah. So do you have, though, a wartime or a post-war recipe that you would recommend to us?
I love the wartime Christmas cake, actually genuinely love it, but you do have to change it a lot to get there. So I think for this one, I'm going to plump for a banana plum pudding because I love bananas. I think they're really, really good. And we can't do Christmas without having a proper plum pudding. I just feel quite strongly about that. And it's a recipe I found in a book by Elizabeth Cray. It's called Banana Dishes. And Banana Dishes is an extraordinary book. And there's a lot to love about it, especially the level of gammon and pineapple and where the pineapple has become banana. And it's very clear that's all she's done. And there's a lot of very good sort of banana sweets in there and banana charlottes and banana, just banana things. But she has a plum pudding where she adds banana to it. And actually, it's the shiniest plum pudding I've ever come across. It was amazing, this dish. All the others that I tested were kind of dull and pudding-like. And it's fine, because obviously you pour lighted brandy over them and nobody cares. But this was a beautiful-looking dish. And also the banana kept it very moist and lightened it. So for non-plum pudding lovers, I would say it's quite a good bet to go down. And, you know, it's all the usual things, suet and fruit and spice and blah, 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 and then bananas. And it's kind of surprising and kind of cool.
Yeah. So is there anything that you would take from either a wartime or a post-war Christmas that you would want in 2021?
I think I would take from the wartime era, and with a nod to the fact that the modern Christmas, there is a lot of plastic crap around, you know, not to put too fine a point on it. I would take that idea of Christmas is whatever you want it to be. And it can be something that doesn't involve vast quantities of plastic tinsel and things bought for the sake of it. Because if you couldn't get hold of this stuff, you could still celebrate Christmas at that point. You could do an awful lot of things with paper chains made out of newspapers. And I'm not unrealistic enough to suggest that we all start kind of make, doing and mend and spending vast quantities of time on crafts to decorate our house. But I do think it's important to remember that you can have a good Christmas if you want it to be a good Christmas. And that the you can spend as much as you want to on things, but it still won't be a good Christmas. But you could also spend nothing on things and it could be an amazing Christmas.
Mm. A nice note to end on. Thank you for guiding us through this fabulous journey through many centuries of Christmas feasts. My final question is what you will be eating this year.
Well, I acquired an outdoor pizza oven, and last year's Christmas dinner, I have to admit, was pizza. And it was so successful that I'm going to do it again. We did a spam and pineapple pizza last year, because I don't care what people say. It's the King of Pizzas. And I also did a basically a stuffing pizza as my other one. So I did pork sausage meat with apricots and chestnuts. So I'm going to ring it up this year. And I think I'm going to do a plum pudding and bacon pizza because that will be immense. And the stuffing one was very good. So I'm thinking in a sort of chestnut, cranberry, turkey, bacon scenario for the other one. And I think just to end, I will have ice cream because it's a good palate cleanser. And we will almost certainly sit down to some wine chocolate in the evening while I don't know what we'll eat in the evening. Something beautiful. Probably cake. Cake and cheese, I'm afraid to say, is a big thing for me. So I will have made a 12th cake or a big Christmas cake, iced up gloriously with royal icing, and that with a slab of something like Kirkham's Lancashire or Montgomery's cheddar or a really good Wensleydale. That, to me, is the perfect Christmas supper.
That was Annie Gray. Her book, At Christmas We Feast, Festive Food from Down the Ages, is available now, published by Profile. Annie also wrote a feature on historical Christmas feasts for the Christmas issue of BBC History magazine, and that is on sale now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.